Civil resistance is a broad technique of struggle that includes all kinds of different methods of nonviolent action, including sometimes civil disobedience. Civil disobedience is a particular method where the idea is basically to deliberately break a law that one views as unjust in order to then publicly suffer the sacrifice of breaking it. And so John Lewis engaged in civil disobedience and went to prison for it. But people who live a life of nonviolent struggle the way that John Lewis did, they make a lot of sacrifices. And they understand, too, that there's a purpose to the sacrifice, that the sacrifice can be useful to them and to the movement in trying to dramatize the injustice that they are facing.
That's Erica Chenoweth, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Erica Chenoweth on nonviolent civil disobedience. As Jesse Jackson advised, when we act out of fear rather than hope, we get bitter rather than better. Nonviolent civil disobedience gives us hope. At a time when people protesting are taking to the streets in greater and greater numbers, civil disobedience is an effective tool of resistance. It was used by Gandhi, Dr. King, Bishop Tutu, and others. From India to South Africa to Alabama, civil disobedience worked. Unjust laws are challenged and are rolled back. But it's not easy. Resistors pay a price: imprisonment, financial penalties, beatings, even death. But all the while, occupy the moral high ground and strive to build the beloved community. Our guest today is Erica Chenoweth. She teaches at Harvard's Kennedy School, where she directs the Nonviolent Action Lab at the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy. Professor Chenoweth spoke at the First Congregational Church in Boulder, Colorado, in February. And now, Erica Chenoweth.
The folks who are gathered here this evening are coming with some big questions. Among us, as I understand it, are federal workers who've been unceremoniously laid off after faithfully working as civil servants. NCAR staff wondering about their future, students, scholars, and academics who felt pressure to conform to new ideological projects or risk being targeted instead, immigrants and families of immigrants and friends of immigrants who fear for their lives and their livelihoods, parents who've been worrying about what kind of political culture, what kind of climate, what kind of economy their children will inherit, and retirees who cannot believe that they're spending their golden years at church meetings about countering authoritarianism in America. We have all watched with horror the events that have unfolded in Minneapolis and St. Paul over the past few months, and we have held the awe of the community's collective response, and we have held feelings of fear about whether our communities, whether our neighbors, whether our families will be next. So I want to acknowledge all that people are bringing and all that people are holding in this room tonight. It is rooms like this in the U.S. and around the world where people over history have come together to organize the most iconic mass movements that have changed the world. So I know some of your questions. Where are we right now as a country? Like, what's the score? Where are we headed? What can we do? What should we do? How can we take care of ourselves, our families, our neighbors, our communities, our children, our grandchildren? This is not going to be one of my more nerdy talks up front. The talk is going to have three parts. First, the bad news, then the more encouraging news, and finally, a pep talk, okay? Okay. So let's dive in. First, the bad news. In my view, we are indeed at a crossroads in U.S. history. We're at a moment in which civil society and civic institutions are either going to figure out how to collectively push back and defend democracy in the United States, or the United States is going to slide deep into authoritarianism. Democracy is a process. It's not a destination. No democracy is perfect. Ours certainly never has been. But there are some basic, minimal standards in terms of rule of law, separation of powers, checks and balances, voters choosing their leaders rather than leaders choosing their voters, and respect for basic rights, like free expression, assembly, due process. These are the foundational elements of any free society, the essential building blocks that allow for the pursuit of many different possibilities and collective futures. Now, at the current moment, the U.S. is in the midst of acute challenges on every one of those dimensions and more. Key government institutions meant to check presidential overreach have largely collapsed in response. The executive branch has been effectively purged of meaningful opposition and oversight. Congress is fully acquiescent and is an effective implementation arm of the executive branch. The federal government openly attacks the autonomy of blue states and cities while aligning its brutal policies with red state trifectas. We see the executive branch suing federal judges in entire districts over their immigration rulings, in which they merely uphold the constitutional principle of due process. We see justice undone through pardons to the president's supporters, including those who have committed violent crimes on his behalf, and retaliatory investigations of his critics. Now, even within the judiciary, we see unsettling trends of deep fissure. The political scientist Adam Bonica has argued that whereas Trump has lost 94% of court cases in federal courts, so far he has won 94% of Supreme Court rulings, including some incredibly consequential rulings. So a judiciary at war with itself cannot constrain a tyrant, and that the high court seems prepared to reinterpret the Constitution in Trump's image means there are few, if any, effective institutional checks on his power. Meantime, lawless assaults on our communities have been escalating, and the clock is ticking on mounting an effective response. Once an autocratic clique has successfully seized control of key institutions, consolidation becomes easier over time. If it feels like it's getting worse more quickly, that's because it is getting worse more quickly. As institutional checks and balances are dismantled inside the government, there is less friction when the government begins directly bullying corporations, unions, educational institutions, mayors, religious figures, opposition politicians, immigrants, and ordinary people in our society. And there are fewer obvious ways to seek redress for injustice. So that leaves us, civil society, as the beachhead for democracy in the United States. And this is where there is some good news. Each of us can do a great deal. And it matters what we do. It matters what we do individually. It matters what we do collectively. It matters what we do today. It'll matter what we do tomorrow, next week, and the week after that. And it matters what people in positions of power and influence will do as a result. It is easy to feel overwhelmed by the call to stand up against tyranny. But what we learned from countries that have come back from the brink is very important and in many ways reassuring. In almost every major historical example of the past 125 years in which societies have faced democratic backsliding or organized against autocratic rule, movements, civil society, is what made the key difference. Across history and across geography, democracy movements have won through civil resistance, which is where ordinary people decide to work together in a coordinated, strategic way to defend, demand, and improve democracy through nonviolent action. The most important factor in determining whether those movements succeed is a strong and sustained defense of freedom, justice, and accountability from the grassroots to the grass tops. And this is because no government, no matter how tyrannical, is monolithic. Every tyrant or aspiring tyrant is totally dependent on the cooperation, obedience, and help of thousands of people in different pillars of support. Aspiring autocrats like to project strength, permanence, and absolute loyalty and fealty. And they're doing that to make people feel powerless, alone, demoralized, and demobilized. But we're not powerless. We're not alone. Actually, people who oppose oligarchy, autocracy, and dehumanization of other human beings are in the vast majority in this country. And autocratic power is not permanent. It's super fragile. That's why they're trying to project that it's permanent. Over history, successful civil resistance movements have a few things in common. First, they attract an ever-growing number of participants from all walks of life who ultimately seize the momentum and build a center of gravity that can be a countervailing force against the tyrannical power. And they focus that popular energy on making sure that key pillars, the civil service, the business sector, political leaders, local leaders, organized labor, religious and cultural authorities, police and military forces, and the like, ultimately align with the democracy rather than the autocracy. Successful movements build resilience and maintain organizational discipline, even as violence or the threat of violence against the movement escalates. And finally, they innovate new tactics, building methods of nonviolent protest and persuasion, non-cooperation, and alternative institutions through which they experiment with building the beloved community that they wish to see. So how are we doing? Here's some more good news. I believe we're witnessing the emergence of a powerful movement of movements that has the capacity not only to disrupt the consolidation of Trumpist authoritarianism, but also to envision an irresistible future for America's next chapter. There are perilous waters ahead, but we have everything we need to build the country and bring it to a better place. So first, let's talk about numbers, the first of those four factors of successful movements. My team at the Crowd Counting Consortium has tallied tens of thousands of protests in the past 13 months. The volume of protests is growing by the month. January 2026 featured the third largest number of protests in U.S. history. They were surpassed only by the historic uprisings after the killings of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and Ahmaud Arbery in June 2020, and the student walkouts and marches of March 2018 after a school shooting in Parkland, Florida, which at the time were the largest single-day demonstrations in U.S. history. Two of the largest mass demonstrations in our country have then since taken place in June and October of 2025, during which millions of Americans from all walks of life came onto thousands of town squares, thoroughfares, and bridges to register their opposition to autocratic consolidation. At the same time, we can witness a growing realization that protests are both deeply necessary and deeply inadequate on their own to prevent the consolidation of autocratic power. And so in cities and towns across the country, communities are getting together and they're organizing to raise the alarm about ICE abuses with hundreds of thousands of whistle kits distributed to people from all walks of life who have been radicalized, basically, by watching what ICE has done to their neighbors. And sometimes, for the first time in their lives, they have watched their neighbors, their friends, their children's school teachers hauled out of their lives and separated from their families by masked government agents and come out on the street and said no. I'm sure you are all thinking of the killings of Renee Good and Alex Pretty, which we know about only because of the people in their community who had volunteered as observers and prepared to film and distribute the footage to thwart the inevitable attempt at a cover-up. Those types of things don't become known unless communities are prepared to record and share what they are experiencing. I hear daily stories and outreach from people as diverse as high school students starting new chapters of concerned citizens in their rural town to understand how they can push back effectively against the indignities that they are witnessing in their communities. It is impossible to overstate just how important these visible signs of resistance are and will continue to be as the consolidation effort continues, because authoritarianism absolutely cannot fully consolidate when people are willing to take risks to demonstrate their commitment to democracy through nonviolent action. And people aren't just protesting in blue areas, just so you know. We are seeing much more protest in red counties, too. The increase in protest participation is also greater in those counties. And in counties where he won by at least 5 percentage points, the average protest participation has increased by 250%. So that's participation and diversity of participation. How about tactical innovation? So remember that movements that win are the ones that translate protest participation into powerful forms of leverage, whether at the ballot box or in alternative institutions, in mutual aid networks, or through economic non-cooperation, such as campaigns of consumer boycotts or withholding labor, to impose costs on pillars that are helping the regime to consolidate power. People saying no, individually and collectively, especially when it's costly to do so, is what puts the brakes on consolidation. We are also seeing this appetite for non-cooperation through boycotts, boycotts, and blackouts. There have been campaigns to sell back Teslas, boycott Target, corporate shareholder votes rejecting proposals to eliminate DEI in places like John Deere. We've seen attempts to unsubscribe to Disney have a magical effect on reinstating Jimmy Kimmel. We've seen boycotts of Spotify making them end running ads for recruiting ICE agents. We've seen economic pressure campaigns on Avelo Airlines, making them come to a different decision about whether they wanted to be involved in deportation efforts. So these have been largely successful economic campaigns, very interesting experiments from which there's much to learn, and ultimately moving to the ability to withhold labor through strikes, perhaps the most effective method of nonviolent resistance that has ever been developed by people, are things that people are now talking seriously about. Then there's the flourishing of alternative institutions, building beloved community, building a vision for a future that appeals, that is irresistible. We're seeing it through the development of mutual aid networks, organizations of workers who've been laid off, and a new civic solidarity. New media, new ways of solving local problems that make the autocrats' vision old news and irrelevant. A new culture, new stories, new ideas can help to build the vision for a bigger we. And what about the impacts on these pillars of support? Well, in the US today, the response of key civic institutions has been pretty mixed. So far, as with many autocratic contexts, some institutions are more naturally positioned to resist autocratic intrusions, and others don't really move on their own. Trump's early moves to purge the civil service and the military represented in many ways an attempt to inoculate himself against non-cooperation from within those entities. Instead, people sort of have to push those pillars into action. And today we see some movement among key pillars against authoritarianism. Today's gathering is like one tiny micro example of a faith community working to organize itself. Many of our friends in the labor movement have been working to push back from the beginning. The Catholic Church decided to throw its mighty power behind those resisting the administration's cruel immigration policies. University faculties across the country are organizing themselves to push back on violations of their First Amendment rights. And the Committee for the First Amendment is organizing actors, writers, and other creatives in Hollywood to leverage what power they have to protect free expression for everyone. So among pillars who have been more overtly aligned with the administration, the MAGA movement of the Republican Party, big business, big tech, some segments of the evangelical church, Trump's most ardent base of supporters, let's just keep in mind that the critical task of shifting people and their loyalties is not necessarily about converting the most hardcore opponents of the democracy movement. Instead, it's about constraining their power and cutting them off from the sources of support that allow them to dominate others without a popular majority. Although there are no guarantees and there's no way to predict the future, our own country's history tells the story of how an engaged and mobilized civil society has shaped every promising step forward in our nation's progress. For every progressive change we have seen to improve the democratic experiment in the United States, a mass movement was behind it. Whether it was the abolition of slavery, the expansion of the vote, labor rights, women's rights, civil rights, the rights of children, reproductive rights, gay rights, the protection of the environment, Black Lives Matter, and many others. So now it's our turn. And so here comes the pep talk. The first thing I want to say, and this is like really important to me to say this, is that this too shall pass. We need to think with a clear eye about the kind of country we are creating with our words and deeds and through the way we struggle. When we arrive on the other side of this current emergency, which we will, if the goal is democracy, we need to remember that in the house of democracy, there are no enemies. There are only adversaries, at worst. Barbara Deming, who is a feminist activist, described the two hands of nonviolence, one hand that stops the injustice, and one hand that offers an open invitation into vision of beloved community. To stand against authoritarian consolidation, we will need both hands. Now, faith communities are absolutely crucial in strengthening both hands. Consider the end of apartheid in South Africa. It wasn't just de Klerk and Mandela who shepherded South Africa out of a white supremacist system, out of tyranny, and out of the acute possibility of civil war. That effort required all of society, a united democratic front, of which the church played a key role. There is no free South Africa in 1994 without black townships mobilizing marches, strikes, and boycotts, and Archbishop Desmond Tutu and the church he brought behind him. People often ask me whether what we need right now is a broad anti-authoritarianism movement or whether we need a new democracy movement that articulates a compelling alternative. My answer is yes. We are in a both and moment. These two fundamental lines of effort, and many others, can happen at the same time, and indeed must happen at the same time. And what faith communities can bring to a moment like ours is a prophetic vision of love that can inspire, sustain, comfort, heal, and reassure. We will need a new vision in this country, a vision of love, a love of ourselves, knowing that an inconceivably powerful source of perfect love is available to us always and never separate from us. We will need a new vision of love for our neighbors, all of them, and especially those who are afraid, who are alone, and who are in harm's way. We will need a new vision of leadership for our communities in all of their diversity and complexity, and we will need a new vision of leadership for our nation, a new sense of a nation that has not yet come into being. As Reverend Vincent Harding used to say, I'm a citizen of a country that doesn't yet exist. So to my friends in faith who are standing out, I see you, and I thank you for sowing the seeds of the new nation of our time. I want to tell you about one of my mentors, Reverend James Lawson, who was a titan of the civil rights movement. Reverend Lawson had served time in federal prison for refusing to serve in the Korean War as a conscientious objector. And in prison, he read Gandhi's autobiography to learn the technique of nonviolent struggle. Now, he had spent his early career after prison, then teaching and training students and parishioners, including a young John Lewis, about how to wage nonviolent struggle in church basements in Nashville. His movement put into action what they learned, and they desegregated downtown Nashville in one of the most stunningly successful campaigns of the civil rights movement. That was in the late 1950s into 1960. And I first met Reverend Lawson over 50 years later at a talk I was giving in Europe back in 2011. We were both there because it was the peak of the Arab awakenings. And I was brought in as an expert to talk about the statistical analysis of the likelihood of success of nonviolent versus violent cases in the Arab awakenings and what might be needed to support democracy movements that were emerging in that context. It was a really nerdy talk with PowerPoint slides, charts, graphs, statistical tables, discussions of statistical significance. So after the talk, Reverend Lawson approached me afterward and he had some encouragement and a little bit of a nudge. I'll never forget it. He said, Erica, this work is for the whole world. These numbers are so important and I want you to keep talking about them, but I also want you to remember, you gotta have a little faith. And so this brings me to my second point. We know what works. We have everything we need. All the ingredients, all of the knowledge, all of the historical examples. Actually, Reverend Lawson once said to me, I'm so jealous of everything you have at your fingertips. When we were trying to figure out what to do to desegregate the South, we had Gandhi's autobiography in the Bible, and that's what we used. He said, you've got training manuals, you've got statistics. There's no excuse. So we have everything we need to build a movement that can take the country to a better place. But no one can predict the future. And we've never been where we are right now. There are no guarantees. As we build the type of formation, our own United Democratic Front, the movement of movements that will change the course of history once again, we're going to have to act on faith. Not too far from my home in Massachusetts, in a farming town called Heath, there stands a tiny church, the Heath Union Church. You've probably never heard of it. But in the early 20th century, it had a regular visitor, the theologian in exile, Reinhold Niebuhr, who spent his summers in a stone cottage down the road from the church, raising ducks and chickens with his family and serving as a guest preacher from time to time. His daughter recalled that Niebuhr hosted a rotating set of illustrious guests in the radical intellectual and spiritual community that he tried to build there each summer, all of whom were deeply concerned with the rise of fascism, the rise of wealth inequality, and labor conditions that were totally intolerable. They were concerned with attacks on immigrants, the sustained segregation, discrimination, and injustice experienced by Black Americans, not just in the Jim Crow South, but also in the North. These friends included people like the Supreme Court Justice Felix Frankfurter. And the guest list also included another well-known dissident theologian, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who was with Niebuhr in Heath at the church when he made the fateful decision to return to his native Germany in what he knew would be a suicide mission to join the resistance against the Nazis. It was with the knowledge of Bonhoeffer's impending departure to confront fascism head-on that brought pain and worry to the Heath community when Niebuhr penned a prayer that some of you might be familiar with. It goes like this: God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. Living one day at a time, enjoying one moment at a time, accepting hardships as the pathway to peace, taking as he did this sinful world as it is, not as I would have it, trusting that he will make all things right if I surrender to his will, so that I may be reasonably happy in this life and supremely happy with him forever and ever in the next. Amen. Some of you might recognize that prayer from its first part, which is now used around the world today, on memes, in recovery rooms, in ecumenical study groups, in worship services, and even in boardrooms. But in its original context, the prayer was in fact a call to action, a call to courage, a call for people of all faiths and all walks of life to face the facts of what might be required of them to defeat the forces of tyranny in their time. It was a prayer written with pain and anguish, a plea to a more powerful source to give strength, wisdom, and courage to those who needed to walk through their fear and stand with those who were standing up for what's right. Now, Niebuhr wasn't a pacifist, and Niebuhr took issue with pacifists when he felt their commitment to pacifism equated to appeasement. Gandhi and Niebuhr were contemporaries, but Niebuhr did not live to see the tools that Gandhi shared with the world being honed and improved in South Africa, where civil resistance proved essential in toppling apartheid, in Chile, where Augusto Pinochet was finally toppled by effective civil resistance, in South Korea, where in the 80s, and again last December, South Koreans rose up to confront military dictatorship and break through to freedom. These examples from the past and the present provide inspiration for us today. The technique of civil resistance is our inheritance, and these lessons teach us that, yes, the arc of history is long. It is long, and it does not bend toward justice on its own. Last year, I had breakfast with a longtime benefactor of the field of civil resistance, who also herself worked internationally in the field of conflict resolution, and I was sharing with her some of my despair about the crackdowns against peaceful protesters in Myanmar, in Venezuela, people we know, the rising bloodshed around the world, and my concerns for the future of our country in a period of such uncertainty and change. And she said to me at the end of the conversation, "Do you know why light will always overcome darkness in the end? It's because light has a source, a powerful source. Darkness has no source. Darkness is just the absence of light. It cannot sustain itself against the arrival of light. So, let's not give the autocrats what they want. Instead of succumbing to the isolation, the fear, and the demoralization that they so desperately need us to feel, know now and always that you're not alone. Organize your own community, your own sphere of influence, to wield your resources even more powerfully. Be unrelenting about it. Throw your support behind those who have raised their hand to lead in these times. Our country is full of folks who are doing the hard work on the ground already to organize their communities, mobilizing against injustice, litigating against unlawful acts, providing direct services for those who've been harmed by the government, supporting the families of people deported, disappeared, or detained, and doing the hard and necessary work of envisioning what comes next. You are among them. So you deserve support, and you can support others. This is the great struggle of our time. So most importantly, don't believe the lie that our current situation is beyond repair. This too shall pass. Take courage, stay the course, knowing that those who choose to stand and lead for a more perfect union today are the ones who are going to shape the country and the world to come. Thank you.
You're listening to Erica Chenoweth on Nonviolent Civil Disobedience. This is Independent Alternative Radio.
Talk a little bit about higher education, and given your position in a distinguished faculty at the Kennedy School, I'm sure you were observing not only what was going on in Cambridge, but the higher ed community around the country. And it pained me not to see that community stand up for itself with greater unity and coherence.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I have a couple of things to say. The first is that Harvard remains the only institution in the country that has sued the administration. We did it twice. We won both suits. And you know that you're in a democracy when you sue and you win a lawsuit, you win. When you sue and you win a lawsuit and you still lose, that's evidence that you're not in a democracy. And so just from being on the inside there, I can tell you that there's a price to pay for standing up. And that helps us understand why so few others have done it. Now, that's true at the institutional level. At the faculty level, though, there has been much more going on. So clearly, faculties have also themselves launched independent lawsuits through the AAUP and the AFT and a variety of other kind of formations. And they also have been winning their suits in huge numbers, right? But the thing is that authoritarian consolidation works when it's kind of a surprise, like when nobody really sees coming the extent to which a tyrant will try to dominate educational and cultural institutions so early in order to, you know, seize the ability to determine what type of ideas are even allowed to be discussed. But if you know about all of the recent cases of backsliding, you know that universities and media are kind of the first place they go, right, is to try to consolidate. What nobody really has appreciated until this, our own instance, is how quickly that can happen. And that universities just really aren't positioned to be like vanguards of the resistance in a normal functioning democracy. They're just not built that way.
One of the things I am aware of that goes on at the Kennedy School is the work that your colleague John Della Volpe does with especially young voter questions. And some of that data, I believe, has indicated a real erosion in the belief in democracy among our young people, which raises the question, given that young people are often sort of the shock troops of civil resistance, how do you reconcile that?
I think there's a huge difference between public opinion polls that tell us that young people are feeling completely disenchanted and disgusted by the political system, and the observation that they still remain like the vital engines of civil resistance movements. Those two things can happen at the same time, and often do happen at the same time. My colleague Matthew Siebel and I just published a piece a couple of weeks ago in the Journal of Democracy about this like new wave of Gen Z protests happening all over the world. The only successful civil resistance movements we've seen in the last year have been youth movements in Bulgaria, in Sri Lanka, in Bangladesh, in Korea to some extent. And it has been like youth power that has driven those campaigns against authoritarianism. And so these two things can coexist at the same time. And I don't actually think people filling out a survey saying that they think that political violence is, you know, sometimes necessary or something is the same thing as them being willing to do it, right? So, but we see, what we can see is that people are showing up in large numbers in these movements. You know, there were a lot of observations early on in the protests that were happening that people were saying, oh, you know, it looks like it's mostly like elderly folks at the No Kings. First of all, I didn't actually notice that in the ones that I was watching up close. But the second piece is that if you've seen what's happened over the course of protests in the U.S. in the last year, the people who are out like doing the anti-ICE protests everywhere are largely like millennials and young people. So it's just sort of like you can sort of reconcile public opinion polls with behavior by just looking at what people are doing rather than what they're checking a box saying.
I was heartened that in your structure of what needs to be happening, the demonstrations do matter. Because there's a sense when you're out there on the street, is anybody listening? Is anybody going to pay attention?
For me, the question is, what would have happened if nobody was out there? Did we prevent something even worse from taking place, right? And I think having very large shows of popular participation is part of what shows that there are going to be costs, even if it's symbolically they're just being, you know, kind of put on display in symbolic terms in large-scale protests, but they also demonstrate a capacity to impose political costs, economic costs, social costs, you know. And so I think it's really important that people have stood up, and I don't think they should be discouraged by not seeing immediate impacts of that action.
And in your analysis of the major ingredients in successful resistance, you talk about creating defections. So what do we know about what goes into the minds of the power elites, that some of whom will ultimately need to defect?
Yeah, so, you know, this is kind of an interesting area, because for a long time, most of the research, including mine, really focused on the question of, you know, whether and how security forces would defect. There weren't too many theories of it, but the theory kind of went like this, which is, if you get enough people from enough walks of life engaged in a civil resistance movement, invisible opposition, somebody's going to know somebody who's in the security forces, and those, and the, you're going to start to have these social connections that make it very difficult for the security forces not to eventually begin to weaken in their loyalty to the regime. And so that was kind of the theory. We've seen this play out in many cases in the 20th century. Like, you can think of the iconic examples of protesters putting carnations in the end of gun barrels in the Carnation Revolution in Portugal, or in Serbia, there was this very kind of iconic example of the Serbian police refusing to fire on demonstrators in Belgrade because they recognized their own family members in the crowd. And those are like the iconic examples that built a lot of theory, and that we, you know, showed through a lot of data were a linchpin in the sort of success of these movements. There's been something important that's happened, though, over the last 25 years, which is that autocratic governments have learned about that. And so what they have done is learned how to adapt to knowing that they need to keep their security forces aligned with them, and that's the most important thing they need to do. So there have been fewer and fewer defections over time in many civil resistance campaigns around the world. And I think what this means is really three things. The first is that we need a better theory for what makes people defect in different pillars, not just kind of an idea that if you send in a bunch of people, somebody's going to know somebody and it'll like magically have an impact politically. So that's number one. Number two is that we need to think about different pillars. So if the security forces are unavailable for defection, like say they were in South Africa, what they did was they focused on the business and economic community as the key pillar that needed to defect in order to bring down apartheid. And that is how it happened. The security forces never defected. The third thing we need to do is build strategies then that kind of recognize that defections in the key pillars of support are how these movements win, not just huge numbers of people, but numbers of people that translate their power into those pillars defecting. So we did a study, Zoe Marks, Andrew Hawking, and I, a couple of years ago that we published. What we were trying to do is build a computational model that could test three strategies. The first strategy is like the magical mobilization strategy that I described, where if you just take as many people as you possibly can and get them in the streets as quickly as possible, like how long does it take to win, basically? And then the second strategy is what we called a naive pillar strategy. And the strategy in that model was basically to go to the nearest pillar of one's community, like influential person in one's community that's closest to you, and just start like trying to get them to defect. That's the naive pillar analysis. And then the third strategy is what we called an informed pillar strategy. The informed pillar strategy is when the protesters as agents had some information about which of the pillars in their community were feeling kind of ambivalent, and they went to them first. And it creates a cascade of defections, because if you go for the low-hanging fruit and they defect, it can create other defections. So then we ran this computational model, and it turned out that that third one, the informed pillar strategy, is by far the most successful. It's in the like 80-90% range of success, even with smaller numbers. Whereas the mass mobilization strategy worked if it worked, which is to say, if you really could get like 10% of the population in the street very quickly, that would work, but it almost never happens.
You also write about the role of technology both on the organizing level, and I'm concerned about the role of technology on the in behalf of the repressive powers, and in particular, where we're going to go with facial recognition and tools that a repressive state can bring to bear against all of us.
I would just say this has been part of why so many movements, I think, have struggled to adapt to the new sort of challenging terrain that we're in, is because there's a huge kind of technology gap between what movements are doing and what is being waged against them on the tech side. And it's not just surveillance. It's like much more sophisticated uses of technology to spread terrorizing images of like what ICE is doing to scare people, to make them feel, you know, demoralized and everything, and to spread misinformation and things like that. So it's unbelievably complicated and overwhelming. I don't know that I have any really good ideas other than I'm really into like in-person conversations and action right now, in part because I think, you know, a little more analog action is not a bad idea.
You also write and have lectured about the dynamics, not just of civil resistance, but civil disobedience and the costs and benefits that come from the disobedience tactic. I had the good fortune of being a classmate in my first election to Congress with John Lewis. So, you know, was inspired by John and all that he had been through in his remarkable life.
I mean, civil disobedience is something, for those that aren't aware of the difference between civil resistance and civil disobedience. So civil resistance is a broad technique of struggle that includes all kinds of different methods of nonviolent action, including sometimes civil disobedience. Civil disobedience is a particular method where the idea is basically to deliberately break a law that one views as unjust in order to then publicly suffer the sacrifice of breaking it. And so John Lewis engaged in civil disobedience and went to prison for it. But, you know, people who live a life of nonviolent struggle the way that John Lewis did, they make a lot of sacrifices. And they understand, too, that there's a purpose to the sacrifice, that the sacrifice can be useful to them and to the movement in trying to dramatize the injustice that they are facing. And that was like a key part of the strategy of the civil rights movement, of the Quit India movement, of the non-cooperation campaign in India, and many other kind of Gandhian-inspired examples.
Yeah, at least my memory as a young man with the civil rights movement in full force was that the willingness to submit to the consequences of civil disobedience was a critical factor in getting defections from the authorities.
Yeah, I mean, that's the theory, and I think sometimes it worked, right? And sometimes it didn't. And so I think the main thing to know about civil disobedience or any act of being deliberately arrested or put in harm's way is that, you know, it's pretty unpredictable what happens from there. And so the most important thing people need to do is prepare themselves for anything that might come to pass and their families and their communities in order to be resilient to what might happen.
Have you or any of your colleagues sort of studied what went on in the minds of the repressive forces in the South in those days that ultimately changed where they ended up? There's some dramatic examples, George Wallace in his later years deciding to be a different human being.
There's sort of two views on this. One view is that view that part of the power of nonviolent action is it opens up the possibility of a kind of a spiritual awakening, right, among the opponents of the movement. And then there's another point of view, which is that it's quite dangerous to rely entirely on hoping for conversion, that in fact, defections are not about changing minds. It's about changing interests and putting constraints on people's actions so that they can't continue doing the harm. And that movements that either overvalue or build their strategy on kind of a hope of being able to melt the hearts of their opponents are on dangerous ground. You can sort of understand one of those perspectives has more spiritual roots and the other has much more kind of utilitarian strategic approach. And I think that it's hard to get at which is actually happening in the data.
Well, you alluded in your remarks to the particular role and one would hope leverage that communities of faith have to play in these days and in this effort.
Yeah, so I was thinking of Jim Lawson because he was himself a man of faith. The first thing is that he used the church basements as gathering places for teaching, learning, and training. You might remember seeing some footage, if you've had any kind of encounters with history on the civil rights movement, like black and white footage of activists, white and black, in church basements undergoing training where they were being beaten by their peers. Those were Jim's trainings. And what they were doing was they were trying to build resilience and honestly like emotional regulation to be able to sit in their seat at a lunch counter, knowing that the Ku Klux Klan was going to come in and try to drag them off their stools, or the police were going to come and they were going to harass them and they were going to try to make them turn around and punch them in the face, right? And so he was teaching them to take all kinds of insults and beatings and people putting cigarette ashes in their hair and burning them and just sitting there with dignity in their power, in order to create a community of activists that was prepared for the abuse that they were about to experience, they needed a spiritual basis of comfort, you know? And so he was also able to offer theological tools. He was able to offer a strategy that was based in Gandhi's strategy. He was encouraging people to ask questions about it and challenge, you know, the group about it. But they would use that space well. He told me once that there was a really important moment in the kind of climax of the Nashville campaign where a bunch of the students had been arrested for sitting on lunch counter stools, which was not illegal. But they'd been arrested in huge numbers, and they just filled the jails, right? And there was this black lawyer in town named Alexander Luby who agreed to represent these students for free. And Alexander Luby's home was bombed by the Ku Klux Klan for doing this. The immediate response to it was Lawson and the other leaders of the movement calling a silent march from Luby's home to the steps of City Hall. And so they gathered at Luby's home and they started doing this silent walk through the city, and people started to gather. And they thought brilliantly, I think, that if they did a silent march, there were a couple of things that were powerful about it. The first is it was very accessible. Anybody could know and participate who wanted to. But it was also going to be clear who was there to provoke. Because in a silent march, you're either being quiet or you aren't. And so you can manage the provocateurs. And then the third reason it's powerful is because it's powerful. It's powerful to see 5,000 people walking down the street in silence from the site of an atrocity to City Hall. And so when they got to City Hall, they had their cameras on, rolling. And they'd invited the press to come, and Mayor West came out of his office and met them on the City Hall steps. And Diane Nash, a black student from Fisk University, walked up to the mayor and said, "Mayor West, do you believe that it is right to deny somebody service on the basis of the color of their skin?" And he said, "I don't think it is right." And they got him saying it on camera. And from that moment forward, there were negotiations to desegregate the downtown. You know, you can't have that kind of discipline without some powerful resilience, trust in one another, strategy, and being able to really put up with a lot of nonsense in order to get to a point where you can fully express your power.
You talk specifically sometimes about the unique role that women can play in the resistance movement, and I wanted to invite you to elaborate on that a bit.
Yeah, I mean, I'll share my story about the Irish Ladies Land League, which is one of my favorites. So in the late 19th century, Ireland was a colony of Britain, and there was, understandably, after the Great Famine, when Irish people were starving in huge numbers, there was a lot of, like, anger about that. And so things really started to get serious and kind of an independence movement toward the end of the 19th century. And there was a lot of agitation that was going on among the Land League. And so the British government shut it down. They banned the Irish Land League entirely, but they totally underestimated the Ladies Land League, who they just thought of, you know, a bunch of bourgeois women probably sitting around having tea. We don't know. They weren't. They were pretty serious. And they came up with this idea that if they could prevent the wealthy British landowners from coming to the country and extracting rents, which they would do, then they could make it so they couldn't come and take their food and their land away from them, because they would kick them off their tenancies and everything all the time. So they organized an ostracization campaign, with their initial target being this one wealthy British landowner who came to County Mayo to collect his rents. His name was Captain Charles Boycott. And they organized a campaign where they knew if we don't let him buy groceries in our town, we don't cook for him, we don't tailor his clothes, we don't launder his clothes, we don't look at him, we don't pay any attention to him, he's never going to come back here. And so they organized that campaign, and you know what? He never went back there. And that's where we get the term boycott. So the reason I share this story is because, why is it important that the first boycott was figured out by the Ladies Land League? Well, they had the social knowledge of, like, what it takes to live in comfort. They're the ones who, like, figured out, like, what a person needs to sustain a happy life and are sort of like, we don't need to give that. That's social knowledge. They just, it's not because they're innately that way. It's just because that's when they've been socialized that way. You know, Zoe Marks and I are writing a book right now where we added data to a global data set of mass revolutionary movements that looks at the demographic composition of the movements by gender, by youth, and a few other measures. And what we found is that a major underappreciated, like, omitted variable in a lot of previous studies, not just about how mass nonviolent action works, but how democracy even spread in the 20th century, was the huge numbers of women who are participating in the front lines of those movements. We found that when more women are participating, when they're like basically at gender parity in terms of the representation of women on the front lines, those are the movements that were the most likely to create the defections of security forces. And those were the movements that were the most likely not to have then huge fatalities. And they were also the movements where they were most likely to see a transition to democracy afterward. And when I look at the Smile Revolution in Algeria in 2019, one of the activists that I interacted with in recent years was from Algeria. And there's this famous photo of this woman who is looking at these riot police on International Women's Day, March 8th of 2019. And she's just kind of looking at them and talking to them. And they're all standing there with these looks on their faces like, oh my God, this is so awkward. And I asked one of my Algerian students, like, what is this picture actually about? And he said, oh, that's a really famous teacher. She's really well known in her town. And she was walking up and down that line of riot police. And she was saying, shame on you. I had you in class. You shouldn't be out here. But and then she was going up and down and she was like, you know what? You're frowning because you're hungry, and I'm gonna, you know, make you a, you know, whatever, something to eat. And so she just kept going up and down and like talking to them that way. That was the first day in which there wasn't a fatality associated with that movement. And from that moment forward, it was only a matter of weeks before Bouteflika fell because the military collapsed around him. The lesson to learn of that is really two things. The first is the sort of two hands of nonviolence thing I mentioned, where there need to be both the anti-authoritarian challenges and a pro-democracy center of gravity that can actually serve as an alternative. And what has been missing in a lot of movements, including, I would argue, the one in the United States in 2020, is that it was very good at being anti-authoritarian, but not very good at building an effective center of gravity that could sort of hold and improve democracy and build people along and build a broader positive coalition, like the Yes Coalition. And then the other thing that's just true is, down the road, being able to block the adverse coalition is also a skill and a strategy that a lot of movements don't develop. Mm-hmm. And part of this is because of the sort of reification of leaderless movements, right? The idea that it's better to just kind of be disorganized or whatever. I don't think that's right. I think the cultivation of like a very deep bench of leadership is necessary in order to have that power then to block a counter-revolution. So anyway, those are some of the things that the field is talking about right now, but more will be revealed. Thank you.
You were just listening to Erica Chenoweth on nonviolent civil disobedience. Erica Chenoweth spoke at the First Congregational Church in Boulder, Colorado, in February. The moderator was former Congressperson David Skaggs. Erica Chenoweth teaches human rights and international affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School, where she directs the Nonviolent Action Lab at the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We're an independent nonprofit in our 40th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. To get them, just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to Angie Dickinson-Mickel and Tim Butler. George is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening. We go out with Bruce Springsteen, Streets of Minneapolis.
Through the winter's ice and cold, down Nicolet Avenue, A city aflame fought fire and ice 'neath an occupier's boots. King Trump's private army from the DHS, guns belted to their coats, came to Minneapolis to enforce the law, or so their story goes. Against smoke and rubber bullets, in the dawn's early light, citizens stood for justice, their voices ringing through the night. And there were bloody footprints where mercy should have stood, and two dead left to die on snow-filled streets, Alex Pretty and Renee Good. Or Minneapolis, I hear your voice singing in through the bloody mist. We'll take our stand for this land and the stranger in our midst. Here in our home they killed and roamed in the winter of 26. We'll remember the names of those who died on the streets of Minneapolis.